It's the MPR News Update, Minnesota's news on your schedule. Wednesday, January 16th. Hi, I'm Phil Picardi. On the podcast, how to help kids who have been trafficked for sex and all of the day's news. We start with education. University of Minnesota President Eric Kaler says criticism of the U's administrative hiring is not accurate. Kaler appeared before the state Senate Higher Ed Committee yesterday. Alex Friedrich was there.
The U has taken heat ever since a Wall Street Journal article last month painted it as an overly bureaucratic system with too many well-paid administrators. Kaler says he's unhappy with the status quo, but he told legislators the paper miscalculated the number of administrators the U has hired since 2001. Kaler said the Wall Street Journal used data that makes it difficult to compare universities, and it ignored data that put U hiring into perspective.
And that's why I'm dismayed about the Wall Street Journal's characterization of the University of Minnesota, about how they conflated some of the data, and ultimately how they misreported some of our administrative costs.
Kaler will give the Senate an interim analysis on spending by March 15th.
Alex Friedrich on education. Bloomington-based Rasmussen College is cutting tuition at its 23 campuses across the nation. Tuition at Minnesota campuses should drop an average of 18%. The tuition cut comes at a time when enrollment is dropping for for-profit colleges. But Rasmussen President Christy Waite says that's not why Rasmussen cut tuition.
It is not that. It is responding to a market need. It is not a temporary solution, such as a scholarship. It is a full-blown program available to current students as well as new students.
Rasmussen's national enrollment is down about 12% from 2010. Northeastern Minnesota Congressman Rick Nolan is calling for an immediate end to the American presence in Afghanistan. NPR's Washington reporter Brett Neely has more.
In one of his first acts since swearing in, Nolan has co-sponsored legislation that would immediately end funding for the American war effort in Afghanistan. During his campaign last year, Nolan frequently said the money the U.S. was spending on overseas conflicts would be better spent on roads and bridges back home. Last week, President Obama and Afghan President Hamid Karzai announced plans to draw down most American troops from the region faster than initially planned. But Nolan said that announcement didn't go far enough.
Why should you continue to be putting people in harm's way when you've decided you're going home? That doesn't make any sense to me.
Still, the legislation Nolan is backing isn't likely to go far in the U.S. House because it has limited support from Republicans. Brett Neely, Minnesota Public Radio News, Washington.
The state DNR, the Department of Natural Resources, is promising to improve data security after a worker improperly accessed driver and motor vehicle records. Matt Sepik has that story.
The DNR sent letters to about 5,000 Minnesotans to notify them that over a period of years, an employee accessed their records for no legitimate agency purpose. DNR spokesman Chris Niskanen says the employee allegedly involved no longer works for the department. Niskanen says it's not likely the data were sold or used for any criminal purpose, and he says no Social Security numbers were seen. But Niskanen says the DNR is setting up additional data security training for workers.
We don't have any tolerance for this kind of behavior. We take this responsibility pretty seriously, and we're looking into every possible avenue to make sure it doesn't happen again.
The DNR says those affected should monitor their credit reports.
Matt Sepik there, now Stephanie Hemphill. She says DNR officials and state lawmakers are debating the best way to slow the spread of Asian carp in the Mississippi River.
The DNR recommends a combination of bubbles, noise, and light at Lock and Dam No. 1, also known as the Ford Dam. Bubblers are considered less effective than electric barriers, but DNR officials say the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers is unlikely to approve an electric barrier due to safety concerns. That doesn't satisfy several members of a House Environment Policy Committee, including Chairman David Dill. The Crane Lake DFLer says he wants the most effective barrier possible.
We're going to get in the engineers, and we're going to get around a table and find out why their claims are different, and try and flesh it out to the best of our ability, and then at some point we'll probably end up telling the department what they're going to do.
The DNR says a review by the Army Corps will take at least 6 months.
Stephanie Hemphill looks at environmental issues for Minnesota Public Radio News. Laura Ewan has been following the human trafficking story. 2 years ago, state lawmakers agreed to treat sexually exploited children as victims, not as criminals. Well, the State Public Safety Department has released new recommendations on how to respond to young people who are sold for sex. Laura Ewan says the report recommends asking the legislature for nearly $10 million to help build a comprehensive system of housing and services.
The two-year-old Safe Harbor Act goes into effect next year, and the trickiest part has always been the question of where to put these kids.
Sometimes we have locked up juveniles because there was no safe place for them to go.
Sergeant John Bannemer of the St. Paul Police directs the Gerald D. Vick Human Trafficking Task Force. He says traditionally, law enforcement officers would haul off child trafficking victims to juvenile detention facilities, thinking that was the best option for them.
We knew that they would run from a shelter if placed in a shelter. We knew that they would run back to the traffickers. That's just what happens. You know, our saying has been, night in jail is better than night on the streets for these kids.
Bandemer says law enforcement and prosecutors now widely agree that locking those kids up is the wrong response. The new report recommends creating a statewide network of safe places for them to go. The report estimates that building and operating the shelters would cost more than $8 million. The Department of Public Safety recommends building up to 40 new beds across Minnesota designated for sexually exploited youth. It also suggests placing prostituted children with foster families who have been specifically trained to care for them. Nikki Beasley of the nonprofit Breaking Free says only 4 housing beds in the state are specifically set aside for youth trafficking victims. And those 4 beds are situated at her St. Paul organization, which helps women and girls escape what she and many other advocates call the life.
Well, at Breaking Free, I mean, we're almost always full as far as our housing. We have transitional and permanent housing, but where we're seeing, and I'm sure other agencies would agree, is the need for emergency shelter. There just really aren't enough beds for the growing need that's out there.
Beasley helped craft the recommendations. She sat on a state-convened task force of police, prosecutors, advocates, and former trafficking victims who worked on developing the proposed model for the past year and a half. The plan calls for new staffing, including a statewide director to oversee the trafficking fight and 6 regional navigators to make sure victims get the services they need. And outreach workers would hit the streets looking for kids in need of help at places ranging from libraries to public buses. Beasley says even identifying the victims can be a challenge.
Because they're not walking around saying, hey, I'm a sexually exploited youth. So it's up to us as providers to be trained and to be able to know how do we identify and then how do we assess for what their needs are and then how do we get them into the right services.
Altogether, the plan would require more than $13 million in state, federal, and private money. Squeezing $10 million from a cash-strapped state will be tough. But Representative Tom Huntley, a DFLer from Duluth who chairs the Health and Human Services Finance Committee, says it's going to be a priority for him.
We need it. This has become a bigger problem than we were aware of. It's sort of a long-time thing in Duluth. Certainly, we've had a number of cases in the Twin Cities where young women are basically incarcerated in hotels and put up for sale.
And that's why the report recommends training law enforcement officers on how to pursue trafficking investigations with the child's best interest in mind. John Bandemer, the St. Paul police sergeant, says it's easy for patrol officers to miss the signs that a child has been prostituted. He says even the notion that they are victims rather than delinquents needs to be ingrained in the minds of officers.
That's a big barrier that we have to overcome, not only understanding that within our own law enforcement community, but being able to express that to others. We've made missteps in the past. We've maybe not treated this as it should have been. And law enforcement is it's like a big ship. It's kind of hard to get it to turn around and steer correctly.
But he thinks the new Safe Harbor plan is a good start.
Laura Ewan on the NPR News Update, Minnesota's news on your schedule. State health officials say some people haven't been able to get a flu shot from their primary care clinics. Infectious disease expert Chris Ayersman says some clinics have run out of vaccine and they've apparently chosen not to reorder. She says that does not mean, however, that there is a shortage of vaccine.
Vaccine is still available. You may need to work a little bit harder to find it because your primary provider might not have any right away. But there are certainly other venues where you can be vaccinated. And we certainly continue to encourage people to take advantage of the vaccine.
The health department has a Find a Flu Shot clinic tool on its website. An effort to help Minnesota food stamp recipients eat healthier could shrink as a result of the fiscal cliff deal. You may remember part of the deal right before the new year called for Congress to take action to prevent dairy prices from skyrocketing. Well, that money came directly from a nutrition education program for low-income people. And Julie Seipel says program leaders here in Minnesota are scrambling to absorb the cuts.
A circle of boys, 7th and 8th graders at Washington Technology Magnet in St. Paul, gather around Angie Thornhill and a table of ingredients.
What food groups do we have in here?
Fruit, grains.
Where's the fruit?
Tomato.
Tomato is a fruit, remember? That's the trick one.
With Thornhill's help, the students make taco salad. Then she passes out a McDonald's menu, complete with nutritional information.
Let's see who can do this the fastest. Find out the one that has the most fat in the menu.
The students quickly figure out it's the big breakfast with hot cakes.
So how many grams of fat does that have?
56.
Thornhill is one of more than 100 community nutrition educators across the state who teach cooking and shopping skills to people eligible for food stamps. She says low-income people sometimes think they can't afford healthy food.
So when you show them that you can access foods that are healthy and it's relatively easy to cook, it's not something where you see on TV, it's this gourmet meal and there's all these things you can't pronounce and it's just really far away from your everyday life, it really makes a difference.
Thornhill uses inexpensive ingredients. She suggests alternatives, frozen fruit, if people can't afford fresh. Educators like Thornhill work in food shelves, community organizations, and senior centers. The statewide program is run by University of Minnesota Extension. Bev Durgan is the Extension's dean.
We know the research shows that kids that eat well, parents that eat well, do better at work, they do better at school, it cuts down on health care costs. So this program really is about helping people make better decisions.
But that work took a hit in the recent fiscal cliff deal. The program is funded with federal money, intended to promote healthy eating and reduce chronic disease among people eligible for food stamps. When Congress needed money to avert a rise in dairy prices, it cut funding by 28%, more than $100 million nationally. Minnesota officials expect to lose between $2 and $3 million of a nearly $10 million grant. It's not clear how that will affect the university's program. Durgan says leaders are looking for new funding sources and don't expect to lay off nutrition educators like Angie Thornhill. But she says they may go fewer places and reach fewer people one-on-one. And that, she says, may be less effective.
Those are tough decisions because the research shows it's that one-on-one, working with families and working with the head of the household that makes those food choices. Those are where you can make some of those long-term impacts.
The state's hunger relief advocates say they're disappointed in the cut. Colleen Moriarty, director of Hunger Solutions, says critics of the food stamp program sometimes argue people who receive the benefits buy unhealthy food.
I hear that they think that people don't make good food choices, and this is actually a program that addresses that need.
She favors educational programs like this to influence food choice, rather than restrictions on what people can buy. Still, Moriarty says she understands that Congress needed money to prevent a rise in dairy prices.
This was just really a pressing emergency need. And for dairy prices to go up so radically in such a short period of time would have had a dramatic impact on the people we serve and the public at large.
In fact, Moriarty is relieved that while Congress cut nutrition education, it did not cut food stamp benefits. She's preparing for the bigger battle, the Farm Bill. That bill funds food stamps. The Farm Bill extension expires in September, and some members of Congress have argued for cuts.
That's Julie Seipel on hunger issues. The head of the Federal Reserve Bank of Minneapolis says the central bank's current easy money policies need to be pushed further. Annie Baxter reports.
Last month, the central bank said it would hold interest rates near zero until unemployment falls below 6.5% nationally, so long as inflation remains under control. But Minneapolis Fed President Narayana Kocherlakota says that's not enough. He wants the central bank to continue making it easy to borrow money until U.S. unemployment falls below 5.5%. It's currently at 7.8%.
I do think it's important for the public to know that the Fed is going to stay in an accommodative stance until the economy is much closer to being what one might consider normal.
Kocherlakota forecasts that unemployment will fall, but only slowly. He predicts unemployment will be down to around 7% by the end of next year.
Annie Baxter on business. And speaking of which, New York-based software company Infor is looking to shrink the size of its St. Paul office space when its lease at Lawson Commons expires in 2015. That's according to Curtis Gilbert.
Infor currently rents 260,000 square feet of office space in downtown St. Paul. But spokesman Dan Barnhart says the company will need only half that much in the future. He declined to be recorded for broadcast. Infor bought Lawson Software last year and acquired its 650 St. Paul-based employees. The company says the size of its Minnesota workforce remains virtually unchanged, but it needs less space now because it hosts customer visits at its New York headquarters, and training now happens at a facility in Georgia. Barnhart says technology is also allowing more employees to work remotely. The company may remain in Lawson Commons, but it's also looking elsewhere. Mayor Chris Coleman's office says the city isn't concerned, but it pledged to work with Infor as it evaluates its need for space.
From software to hardware, and specifically medical devices, Martin Moylan says the FDA has released the text of a warning letter it sent to Little Canada-based St. Jude Medical.
The letter concerns a plant in California that develops and manufactures wires that connect an implantable defibrillator to a patient's heart. The watchdog agency had previously criticized testing and other procedures at the facility. Now the FDA says St. Jude's responses so far to the agency's concerns are inadequate or their adequacy cannot be determined. David Furr is a medical device industry consultant.
The warning letter is just a distillation of the issues they felt like were not adequately addressed in their response. What does it mean? It says right there in the warning letter, you can't get approvals of certain of products, and we won't issue export certificates.
Furr said the export certificates would not be a big deal since they would pertain to limited products and their certificates are not required for devices shipped to most countries. Martin Moylan, Minnesota Public Radio News.
Now to close out the podcast, we hear from Nikki Tundell. She has a profile of photographer Javier Tavera's latest work on the diversity of the Twin Cities Latino community. Tavera's current exhibit is on display at Augsburg College in Minneapolis.
Photography is magic. At least that's how Minneapolis photographer Javier Tavera describes the art form. It can snatch up a split second of life and turn it into an everlasting moment. Then there's the way it bridges gaps between strangers.
If I didn't have a camera, and if I approach somebody in the street and tell them, what about if you tell me something about you? That'd be the oddest thing. With a camera in my hand, I can go to people and say, like, I want to take a photo of you. Tell me a little bit about yourself.
And most times, says Tavera, they will.
Just to have that gift from them to me, that is amazing.
His latest project, Calle Lake, or Lake Street, is set along the ever-changing corridor that's come to symbolize multiculturalism in Minneapolis.
I go around and find people that are interesting looking and interesting to talk to.
Calle Lake zeroes in on the Latino residents along the street's five-mile stretch. There's the World War II veteran with the perfectly trimmed mustache and flirtatious personality. The bleach blonde with the long legs and long fingernails, reaching her arms towards the sky. And the shirtless man with a Baroque-like font tattooed across the width of his back. It's his name, followed by that of a former flame. The latter's obscured by a huge X, buzzed on at a later date.
He decided to just cross that out as if it was in a notebook or something that is disposable, but it's his skin. So it was a statement for him, like, that time of my life is over, and I'm going to cross it off. This is who I am right now.
Some in the Latino community question Tavera's subject choices. They say,
you're not photographing the mom, the dad, and the two kids and the dog. That's the Latino family.
But the way the Mexico City native explains it, he's not trying to capture the Latino family, the Latino community. That, he says, would be impossible. His goal is to showcase the many facets of that community.
We're good, we're bad, we are beautiful, we're ugly. And all that makes the Latino community, and that's what I'm trying to photograph.
The power of portraits, says Tavera, is that they allow people to see others in ways they can't or don't in everyday life.
I made some portraits of gang members. People will approach them and go really close to them and look at their eyes and stare at them for as long as they wanted. If one of these guys were passing by, it's like, don't make eye contact, look at the floor, keep on going. But there you have the chance, like, wow, this is another human being that is trying to communicate something to me.
Tavera believes a successful photo leaves room for viewers to add their own impressions. He tells of a woman who spent a long time examining one of his images. Eventually, she asked him to explain the story behind it.
And I was ready with my, this is about this person related to this one and this one. And when I finished my speech, I could see the person very frustrated.
So he asked her what she saw in the photo.
And she came up with a wonderful story about her mom and how the dad related to the other pictures. And I said, you know what? Forget everything that I just told you. Completely erase it from your mind. Keep that story, and that's the real one. There's no other one but that one.
For Javier Tavera, being able to provide that kind of experience through photography, that's magic.
Nikki Tundell reporting from Minneapolis. I'm Phil Picardi here in St. Paul, and this was the NPR News Update for Wednesday, January 16. I'll see you back here tomorrow.